Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session, pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three arguments set on oral submission. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Exxon Corporation versus Mary and Terry Tidwell from Hunt County. Atascosa County Appraisal District and Appraisal Review Board versus Joseph J. Kimrack and others from Atascosa County. And ex parte Craig Hall on original habeas corpus proceeding. Each of these three arguments have been assigned different time for argument by the court. Counsel is aware of that. Counsel for petitioners or relators may reserve a certain portion of their time to make rebuttal arguments. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each of the three causes, but we'll complete all of the arguments before lunch. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may make application with our clerk's office if you desire to hear the tapes of any of these arguments. The court is now ready to hear arguments from petitioners in Exxon versus Tidwell.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Hatchell present argument for petition. Mr. Hatchell has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'm representing Exxon Corporation this morning. This is a negligence suit against Exxon for failure to provide a safe place to work for a tenant's employee. The employee was assaulted on the job, working late at night. We once again confront the issue of the duty to protect against crime. In this context, slightly different from Havner, because we're dealing with the landlord-tenant relationship. The trial was to the court. Judgment was based on findings of fact and conclusions of law, which primarily had two underlying bases. The first being that a master-servant relationship existed between Exxon and a Mr. Morgan, the proprietor of the station, although the court failed to find that there was a master-servant relationship between Exxon and Mr. Tidmore. The second basis for the relationship was what is described in the findings and conclusions as the totality of the relationship between Exxon and Mr. Tidwell, barring which the trial court said there would have been no duty on behalf of Exxon to exercise care in regard to Mr. Tidwell. What I take to mean by totality of the relationship is a blending of the various rights of the landlord and the tenant, which derives out of the lease agreement between Exxon and Morgan, and various rights which derive out of a retail sales agreement between Exxon and Mr. Morgan. The issues which I will discuss this morning will primarily center on the concept of control, because that seems to be primarily where the activity is in this case. We will talk about control of an activity, more or less in the sense as defined by this court in Redinger, and we will then talk about controls regarding the details of the work of Mr. Morgan's station in conjunction with the question of the master-servant relationship. Let me say as to the latter, however, that I do not find, either in the Court of Appeals or in the response to the application for writ of error, any attempt to justify this, the findings and the judgment on a master-servant relationship. I will be more than happy to respond to questions from the court about that and do intend to touch on it briefly, but primarily I intend to focus upon what seems to be the underlying basis for this judgment, and that is the so-called totality of relationship between Exxon and Morgan. I would like to begin by taking a look at where we are today insofar as the extant case authority is, because the decision below takes us far beyond where we are today by a curious mixture of landlord-tenant principles and master-servant principles. The primary relationship out of which this incident arose is that of landlord and tenant. And in regard to landlord-tenant law in Texas today, we have certain bedrock principles which are at issue here. Number one being...
Mr. Hatchell, do you propose or are you advocating that this court scrap the analytical format we've been using for the last 50 or 60 years, which I believe the amicus brief urged?
No, Your Honor, I am not. I hate to argue against one's own amicus, but I did not, in my application for writ of error, go so far, and do not think it is necessary for the court to go so far. I'm somewhat troubled by the very rather dogmatic position taken by amicus in this case, although I do admire the collection of authorities that has been presented to this court. I believe that the basic building blocks upon which this case can be decided already exist in the Wheat decision and in the Redinger decision and in the other cases specifically involving service station leases before the court. I do not view this as a pioneering case. I do, however, view it as one in which it's necessary to confront the issue of what we mean when we talk about control as a basis for liability. Now, I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does.
We begin with the rule in Medlin versus Hamner that a landlord owes no obligation to his tenant to make premises safe for the uses to be made of the premises by a tenant. And then we follow that basic landlord-tenant principle with a perhaps the most recent holding by Mr. Justice Gamage in 1986 when he was sitting on the Austin Court of Appeals, in which he says that if a relationship between a hydrocarbon supplier such as Exxon and a service station operator such as Mr. Morgan is a true landlord-tenant relationship, the landlord owes no duty to employees of the tenant. But then comes along Redinger, and Redinger, as the court well knows, imposes the concept that the retention of control by an owner or occupier of premises may give rise to some liability in some particular circumstances. But it's, I think, very central to my argument for the court to understand, my reading at least, of Redinger, which is that liability must arise, if at all, under Redinger, out of the activity which is controlled. And I think that that's going to be very, very important to the unraveling of the somewhat convoluted analysis indulged in by the Court of Appeals. I would, however, like to rhetorically put to the court whether or not Redinger really applies in landlord-tenant situations. Bear in mind that Redinger was a situation where you were dealing with a dynamic state of affairs, the ordering or of the work of subcontractors. It did not involve an owner but an occupier. And in the landlord-tenant situation, almost inherently there is always going to be control of some sort because the landlord always has a reversionary interest in the property, and particularly where commercial leases are concerned that are dedicated to specific uses, as is Exxon's station leased to Mr. Morgan, there is the inherent right of the landlord to protect both the goodwill and the use of those premises. But if we assume, for the sake of argument, that a control concept such as that in Redinger is at play here, it seems to me that we confront two concepts of control. If control is a basis for liability in this case, I say that it must either be that pervasive sort of control, which gives rise to a master-servant relationship, or it must arise, the control must be as to the specific activity which causes injury. And let's look at how that plays out in this particular case. On the first issue, pervasive control, which encompasses the totality of the relationship, look at what the Court of Appeals has credited as the basis for liability. Mr. Morgan kept his station open 24 hours a day. That was a negotiated matter between he and Exxon, and he was paid $6,000 a year to do that. It was a business decision on his part. He was not required to do so. In the Beckham case, which we cite to the court, in the Daniels case, which we cite to the court, and in the McGee case, which we cite to the court, all three service stations operated 24 hours a day. And Beckham says that that is not inconsistent with the landlord-tenant relationship because the landlord, in the specific service station lease situation, always has the right to demand maximum use of the facilities. It is said, well, Exxon required in its contract cleanliness of the facilities. That's dealt specifically by this court in the Wheat decision and in other decisions. Wheat draws a distinction between control relative to the operational details versus the imposition of standards necessary to maintain the integrity of the property. It is said in Wheat that it is perfectly consistent with the landlord-tenant relationship to require as a condition precedent that the premises be maintained in a cleanly manner. The Court of Appeal says, well, they required this facility to be used as a service station. Well, of course, it has aprons and pumps and bays for servicing cars. That is an inherent right of a landlord which would exist without any specific clause in the contract itself. It is always an inherent right of a landlord to demand that property can be used in a certain way if it's devoted to that use. The Wheat decision specifically speaks to this. The McGee decision specifically speaks to this. The Court of Appeal says, well, the lease said that he could not make any alterations to the property. Well, again, that's an inherent right of a landlord. That exists in the concept of waste without being embodied in a particular clause in a lease. It is not inconsistent with a landlord-tenant relationship.
That it included not being able to make any preventive security measures without Exxon's approval?
It all depends on this record, Your Honor. The answer to your question is no, if you're talking to me in terms of any security measures. The answer to your question is yes, if it requires alteration of the premises. And in all candor, I would tell you that that alteration, I think by both parties, was fairly minimal. Like if one had to drill a hole through the wall to install a circuit breaker or something, that would require Exxon's permission. Bear in mind that the trial court has found as a fact in this case, had Mr. Morgan requested any such alteration of the premises to install security measures, Exxon would have granted that right. But he did not ever make such request. It is said that signage standards are evidence of some form of control that fixes liability. But the cases which we have cited to the court say that this is not inconsistent with the landlord-tenant relationship because it is a factor by which the landlord can protect the image of the facilities and the trademark of the products that are sold out of those facilities. The Court of Appeal says, well, we could inspect his records. Well, of course we could. He is running tanks on this property for which we can be liable if they leak. We have a certain obligations, financial obligations, owing back and forth to one another as to which Mr. Morgan stands as a fiduciary to us. And it is not inconsistent with that type of complex financial arrangement that we would have the right to inspect Mr. Morgan's records. It is said that we required him to render appropriate service to his customers. Again, this is not inconsistent with either the landlord-tenant relationship or the retail sales relationship because, again, as in the Wheat, it is a standard. It is not a control which is used to protect the name and trademark of Exxon. It is said that Exxon had the right to modernize the facilities. Again, this is the inherent right of a landlord. It is not inconsistent. It is said that we required the minimum purchase of gasoline. We'll read the Beckham decision, read the Wheat decision. They all involve these types of minimum standards. The ultimate conclusion is of Wheat is You can always enforce standards without making yourself a master. And that's all we see in this particular case.
What about the evidence concerning encouraging the practice of leaving the doors open?
Well, Your Honor, that evidence is in the case only as evidence of control. It is not evidence of liability. It was not pleaded as a ground of negligence, and it was not found by the trial court as a ground of negligence. Mr. Morgan says that he was not instructed or required to do that. And Exxon confirms that. He says that it was a suggestion related, as Exxon frequently does, to its dealers that up bay doors sometimes can give the public the notion that you're in business. But Mr. Morgan recognized that this was not binding on him as a policy that he was required to do to keep his lease. And in fact, he did raise and lower the bay doors as he saw fit. He closed them at night sometimes. He closed them when it was cold sometimes. But the overall record demonstrates, I think, very clearly that it was not a policy of Exxon that was mandated upon Mr. Morgan. It was something that he was free to do or not to do as he chose.
Mitchell, where is the bright line? You've recited a number of elements of control that would be consistent with an agency relationship. Not only what use is to be made of the property, but the manner and nature of its use and the essentials of operation.
Well, I think your question is a very good one.
Where is this
bright
line?
In relation,
apart from a true landlord-tenant relationship to one of mere agency that's couched in terms of a landlord-tenant relationship.
The reason it's difficult to draw a bright line in this case is because of this intermixture of landlord-tenant and master-servant concepts in this case.
When does the tenant become the servant?
Well, I don't think that there's any question under Wheat and in the line of cases he becomes a servant under the standard test when the landlord essentially is able to control the details of the operation.
Sounds to me like you just described the lease where that's the case.
You can go in and
examine the accounts, the books. That extends far beyond safety precautions.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We're talking about the details and the means and manner by which the end result is to be accomplished. Let me just give you one example on this record.
Where is that line? Does it have to get to the point where they say you can't hire this person or you have to hire that person?
Absolutely.
Does it have to go that far before the landlord is the boss?
Yeah, well, it's always a totality of the circumstances. Each case pretty much stands on its own fact.
Do we have a jury in this case?
Does the equality of bargaining power between the two contracting parties enter into this?
I think it could enter into it. It certainly is not made much of an issue in this particular case, but Mr. Morgan was very adept at negotiating with Exxon in this particular case, and in fact, was able to negotiate his way out of certain provisions of this lease. But yes, I think it could easily be a factor. But I don't want to let this go, Judge Gamage, because it's an issue that troubles me as well, trying to get this case sorted out. But let me try to answer with one specific thing that the court found. You say, well, this sounds like a lot of control to me. The trial court, for example, said that Exxon retained the right to require cleanliness. But what did he also hold? He said Exxon did not control the means and the details by which that could be accomplished. And that is at least the distinction which needs to be kept uppermost in mind.
So the means and the details of the particular detergent to be used?
Yeah, right, precisely. Precisely. Or even, as a matter of fact, what standards of cleanliness are.
They vary from one Exxon to another, I can assure you.
It may well be. And as you go through each element of so-called control that is mentioned, you will find a case in Texas which has said that as a matter of law is not the kind of control that is necessary to render one a master servant. Now,
looking at a sort of a totality of circumstances analysis, and that the control may be the pervasive or specific, this begins to resemble personal jurisdiction analysis. Are we just destined in this area to endless litigation over specific facts and provisions of leases?
I think the way the law has developed since Wheat, we probably, if we are going to proceed under the master-servant analysis, we probably are relegated to a case-by-case basis. If we look at it from a Redinger standpoint, Your Honor, I think that the bright line is pretty easy to find, because the basis for liability must arise out of the activity over which control is assumed, and there is no evidence in this case that Exxon ever assumed control over security. That's the best bright line that I can give you. Wheat and the other cases in this area are always long, and they always involve a detailed analysis of the particular lease in question. But bear in mind that the beginning point in that analysis, Your Honor, is with this particular lease, which says that Mr. Morgan is an independent contractor. And the analysis that one has to indulge in that situation under Love is far more than one has to indulge merely to find one an employer, because you actually have to go so far as to find that lease a subterfuge, and that simply is not sustained by this record. But I'm afraid we're not going to be able to get out of a case-by-case analysis because of the complexity with which these relationships now stand in complex society.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel. Pardon me. Court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the Court, Mr. Tim Fulton present argument for respondents.
May it please the Court, as I listen to Mr. Hatchell remark on the general concepts of duty, my first reaction is that we are not in much disagreement on the overall standards that govern. I think where our disagreement comes is in the application of those standards to this case. The issue which has been brought forward by Exxon essentially concerns duty. That's been their position throughout the appeal process. The contention being that a landlord-tenant relationship does not give rise to liability, particularly in the instance of third-party criminal acts. That is to be contrasted, however, with the findings of fact and the conclusions of law made by the trial court in this case. The findings of fact specifically being, as the court has noted earlier, that the bay doors, and let me talk about bay doors for a moment. These are the big doors, as shown from the pictures in the record, that you drive a car in. They stand on they are placed on the side of the building. Findings of fact number 5, findings of fact number 39 provide or hold in this case that Exxon left, as a matter of policy, Exxon required those bay doors to be left open.
Well,
they required them to, yes.
The briefs sometimes say required and sometimes say encouraged.
And let me refer to the finding of fact, because that's really what we're dealing with. Number 5, on November 4th, the day in question, the bay doors, at the encouragement of Exxon, were left open. I would view that as an instance of control being exercised. Finding of fact 39 doesn't deal with a particular day, saying simply Exxon promoted 24-hour operation by encouraging open bay doors as a policy.
Encouraging is different from requiring.
Encouraging is different from requiring. Requiring is a strong exercise of control. Encouraging is less so. But as the exhibits in the record point out, when Exxon encourages a so-called independent businessman to comply, there is a threat that goes along with that. And there are exhibits found in the record to the dealers, letters from Exxon, Exhibit H, Exhibit I, or Exhibit Y, for example. Failure to comply with this requirement on insurance coverage can seriously affect your relationship with Exxon. There's a hammer there that Exxon exercises.
Before you move on from that issue, because I think this is critical on the issue of control,
Mr. Hatchell says that Mr. Morgan at times closed the doors, at times closed the door, opened the doors, depending on the weather, depending on what he thought was best. Do you dispute that?
I don't dispute that that's what the testimony is, and there is conflicting testimony. Mr. Morgan testified Exxon did not tell him that it was a requirement to keep the doors closed.
And had he refused to open the doors at the suggestion of Exxon, would that have been a cause to terminate the lease?
We can speculate what they would have done. I don't think it should have been a cause.
Has there been any cases where Exxon has terminated leases for because of lessees' failure to open doors, the bay doors, at their encouragement?
Not that are in this record. What we have in this record are the letters I referred to a moment ago where Exxon takes efforts to enforce its policies. In this case, the testimony, as I said, is conflicting. Mr. Morgan talks about bay doors in one way, and I think we should bear in mind that Mr. Morgan is a current Exxon franchisee. We have testimony from Mr. Tidwell, strong testimony. He could quote Mr. Morgan's exact words, and then he does so in the record, saying that if Exxon says to leave them open, we are going to leave them open. Mr. Randy Roberts testified that at his Exxon station, Exxon company representatives told him, leave those bay doors open. We want it to look like you're open for business. These are instances of control.
In your analysis, is it important that Exxon exercise control over the bay doors, or of security generally, or of just the premises as a whole, or all three?
It is important to the case, I believe, that they exercise over all three. If I follow where you're going, your question to Mr. Hatchell, are we getting to a point where we analyze these cases similar to the way we look at jurisdiction?
Say that this didn't have anything to do with the bay door. Say it just came in through the front door. Then how would your analysis of the case be?
The analysis would be the same, and talking about the pervasive type of control that Mr. Hatchell mentioned. Saying that there is not evidence in this record of that pervasive type of control, I have to point the court to findings of fact number 18, finding of fact number 19, which hold directly the opposite. As Mr. Hatchell says, there should be liability where the landlord controls the details of the operation. That is, if there's not a bright line, it's far enough over the line, controlling the details gets to liability. Finding of fact 18, Exxon had the right to direct Jerry Morgan in the details of operating the station. That's pervasive control, operating the station. Number 19, on November 4th, Exxon had the right to specify the manner which Jerry Morgan would render services to his customers. I believe that's a direct finding of pervasive control.
Mr. Hatchell makes an argument and tries to say that there's a difference between standards and control. How will you respond to his argument? There is a distinct difference.
That there are inherent rights in a landlord-tenant relationship that should not move a landlord into the liability area. There certainly are. And the items that Mr. Hatchell selects as examples are a good ones. There is a right to receive reports pointed out in Redinger, and that doesn't get you to control. In this case, we have specific evidence of that. Paragraph 6I, paragraph 6J of Exxon's lease talk about what these details are. 6J, Exxon required Morgan to maintain the premises in accordance with Exxon company standards. 6I is similar. That deals, however, specifically with the display of signs. The theoretical difference there, or the logical difference, is the standards they are requiring that he comply with are Exxon company standards. They're not even specified in the contract documents. These are requirements to come later. But he has contracted that he is bound to follow their guidelines, whatever they may be, whatever they may say they are, and whenever he may be told of.
Mr. Fultz? Mr. Hatchell, I think the core of his argument, if I understood him correctly, was that they can exercise all sorts of control, but you still don't abandon or leave the bounds of a landlord-tenant relationship until that element of control which is directly related to the injury is involved. And here he says it is a question of security, and he argues that Exxon never made any effort, never purported to, and did not exercise any control over security. In order for there to be a duty, in order for there to be negligence, they have to have exercised some control over the security of the operation. Where did they exercise this security control?
Let me answer your question in two parts. First, saying that I do not believe we have to reach the point, because of the pervasive control that Exxon exercised over the details, that they are required to they have a duty of reasonable care. But let's step back and take a harder burden and assume for purposes of this analysis that the control does have to directly relate to security. Exxon has a number of requirements and takes a number of actions regarding security. They have, as their representatives, Mr. Atherton, Mr. McNutt, in the testimony described, a security retrofit program where, in order to prevent robberies is one of the main reasons, they will come back and retrofit or work on a station. In the record, Exhibit EE, excuse me, Exhibit HH, is a retailer development course. One of the items Exxon offers to its retailers is a course on security, and that calendar is found as Exhibit HH. In this case, we have findings of fact of the bay doors being left open. Mr. Marvin Wise, a security expert who testified, says that is negligence. That is not what should be done. His report says bay doors should have been shut at all times. But the testimony shows Exxon representatives encouraged the bay doors to be left open as a matter of policy.
Did Mr. Morgan avail himself of the security training program you just mentioned?
It's not in the record if he did. That is something that Exxon offers to retailers. There is no discussion in the record of whether they make them go to it. They send bulletins, the Exxon Extra, to retailers making it available. But to my knowledge, they do not require them to attend.
From your point of view, does the very offering of such a course create a duty to actually render the premises secure? If they undertake to perform in some manner in that area, do they undertake to perform to the extent of securing the premises against this type of assault?
I don't know that we could, on the basis of that analysis alone, move from here to there. Otis Engineering versus Clark, as premises liability cases, as tort duty cases have moved forward, essentially holds if you undertake an act, you're required to undertake that act with reasonable care. That's the El Chico versus Poole case as well. These cases hold that if you're going to do something, there's a duty of reasonable care. That's consistent with Redinger. If you're going to assume some control of an activity over the premises, you have to exercise that control with reasonable care. So I think what you're describing fits, dovetails very nicely into the analysis.
So you think that by offering that type of program, that's the type of activity, if they don't go far enough, they've incurred...
They do, and that is exactly the type of activity that requires them to act with reasonable care. The evidence in this record doesn't stop there.
Well, let me ask the other side of that. What, I guess, by attempting to do something, if a landlord incurs liability because they don't go far enough, what is there to promote the offering of such a security program in the first place? Aren't we better off by landlords offering those sorts of programs as opposed to not offering them and thus not being criticized for not going far enough?
Certainly. And just the analysis, I think, has to boil down on a factual basis on a case-by-case analysis. Did the defendant act in a reasonable fashion? I can envision instances.
So they incur the duty by doing it, and you're saying it's a fact question.
It's a fact question as to whether they breached that duty.
Did your expert say that the bay doors should have been closed at all times? Did I understand that?
He said they should have been closed at all times.
During the day?
During the day. They would have to be open, obviously, when in use, but they should be closed at all times. His report goes further and says that his analysis of neighboring businesses, Pep Boys, he cites, and some others, closed theirs at all times. The reason being for security.
So we're supposed to develop the Los Angeles mentality.
reality. They were going to be attacked any moment.
I don't think we have to develop that mentality, and I would hope that we would not. But what we do have to do is reach a point where when a defendant with control over the premises exercises that control, requires that acts be taken, such as leaving the bay doors open. We're not dealing with a situation where they were left open during the day. Rather, with one where they were left open at Exxon's requirement all night in light of the fact that there was one attendant on duty, in light of the fact that we're in a place where there have been prior robberies, and Exxon knows this is a dangerous condition.
Suppose the agreements in this case had provided that safety measures are left up to the lessee. Landlord assumes no responsibility for them, does not assert any control over them, does not attempt to correct them, but does insist on cleanliness, what credit cards can be used, quality of the gasoline, quality of the service, type of the sign, and so on. How would that affect you?
I think that could, again, depending on the facts and accepting the analysis I think that you're giving me, there can be a situation, I would admit, where a true landlord-tenant relationship exists. A landlord is not always responsible for torts on the premises, and we're not advocating that position.
But how, my
he's not a guarantor.
How can you tell him ahead of time whether he's going to be or not?
Under the analysis that all of us are required to act reasonably.
Well,
and
he comes to you and says, I want to draw up a lease for this fellow, but I don't want to be liable if somebody breaks in and does violence to him. How can that be avoided in the documents if all of these cases turn so heavily on their facts?
The facts break in most of the cases, the ones that I've seen, all the ones I've seen, into two areas. One is what the contracts say, and one is what the parties do. And certainly, I believe contracts could be drawn which would insulate a landlord from liability if he really does not have control under those documents. If the tenant has exclusive control, the landlord does not have the right to come in and renovate, the landlord does not have the right to specify the details of the performance.
If the landlord has the right to make sure that the bathrooms are clean and usable for women and children, is that a sufficient degree of control to hold them liable?
Under the Redinger analysis, I believe that it would be.
Does a landlord have a responsibility to train all employees to use firearms, to furnish firearms for the protection of the employees?
I don't believe so.
Mr. Colts, would you, the type of control that you've talked about is characteristic of franchisor-franchisee relationships generally, is it not?
Generally. That's the amicus point? Or
well,
is that what the court's referring to? Excuse
me. I'm just asking in general without regard to the to that that point of the amicus brief. But your position is that in franchisor-franchisee relationships where franchisor has a right to maintain certain standards so that it so protect the goodwill that its name has engendered among the public, that that's the type of control which would expose them at least to a jury trial on whether the control was sufficient to subject them to liability under these circumstances.
I believe that it could be, and that is not, I submit, an unfair situation either. The reason being that we're talking at the outset about whether there is a right to bring a claim, whether there is a duty that exists. The law in Texas is, as I understand it from this court's opinions, quite a few of them, if the issue of control is resolved, if there is, the defendant has control over the premises, then he is required to act accordingly. In a franchise relationship, there can be that type of control. It is yet another question as to whether there is a breach of that duty or as to whether they did act with reasonable care under the circumstances. We don't get from a point of saying there is control over the premises to a point of automatic liability without that middle step of saying these people had a duty, and they failed to act with reasonable care. That's the safeguard I would submit the system provides. But with the issue of franchise documents, those issues exist for a reason. Those terms in franchise agreements are there for the monetary benefit of the franchisor. He receives a benefit from the franchisee acting in accordance with those standards. He cannot ignore the responsibilities that come with the benefits. If he is going to exercise control to a sufficient extent to reap the rewards, there's another side to that control. He must act with reasonable care under the circumstances.
Well,
that's not an unfair system.
Presumably the franchisee and franchisor both obtain a benefit from the relationship,
sure.
Or I suppose it would not continue. Would you say then that the control over which the franchisor, the aspect of the business must relate to security or just any control whatsoever is sufficient to, for example, over the bathrooms or the
how much is enough?
Yeah.
Justice Hecht asked earlier, I think, in Mr. Hatchell's portion, likened this to a jurisdictional analysis, and I have thought of it in those terms as well. If there is pervasive control over enough, and bear with me on what is enough at this point, if there is enough control over other than security items, and then there is a third-party criminal action, I can envision a scenario where liability would be proper, as I can where there is not that pervasive amount of control, yet the landlord undertakes actions to provide security, to forbid security. Even though there is not that pervasive amount, there could be liability in that case because he's responsible for his actions.
And having undertaken to provide any security measures, they thus incur a duty of ordinary care.
Duty of ordinary care, which under the facts of the case may or may not be breached in a given circumstance.
In this particular case, the felon, the gunman, came in through the bay doors. Okay. Was the front door open?
Presumably it was.
Okay. Would the Exxon be liable if he had come in through the front door?
I don't think that where he entered necessarily is the operative issue. The reason being, if he came in through the front door, being attracted to the premises by the open bay doors, seeing that the loan attendant on duty had to go somewhere else and he was attracted and came in, we're in the same position. So I don't think that liability hinges on which door the assailant came in.
But it doesn't really hinge on whether the bay doors were open, does it? Wouldn't you still argue that even if the bay doors were shut, Exxon exercised such control that it ought to be liable?
Absolutely.
Now, since Exxon should be liable, okay, because it exercised control, okay, what was the duty of Exxon to protect that employee who was working a night shift by himself? You've already said it did not go to the level of providing him with a firearm and firearms training. What was the duty of Exxon?
Exxon's duty was to take reasonable precautions. The evidence in the case showed that the bay doors should have been shut and locked, which the expert testified and which Mike McNutt, Exxon's representative, said is their policy anyway. So they did not only just branch out and find something that do something that was found to be wrong, it was violative of their policy.
But we know that he could have gone in the front door. Okay. What was Exxon's duty to protect this employee? What would have been sufficient to protect this employee?
What I believe this record shows would have been sufficient was to do at this station what Kent McCutcheon did at his station, which was to install a pass-through window if the premises are going to be operated in this location late at night. That's what he did. He asked Exxon to do it. Exxon wouldn't do it. He spent his own money, $700 to $1,000, minimal expense. He did it. He was robbed before he did it. He was not robbed anymore after he did it.
Was there ever a robbery at this service station before?
Yes, there was.
So every establishment has a duty to establish pass-through windows. What about utilities? Do they need to establish these pass-through windows? We live in a society that is quickly breaking down, where law and order are becoming a thing of the past, where there are not enough police, where standard response time is inadequate. And what I'm asking you is, what is the duty of an entrepreneur, of a person who owns a business, to protect his employees?
Your Honor, if I understand the court's question, I cannot tell you whether he should have three guards on duty from 8 to 5 and 4 through the midnight shift. But what he should do is act reasonably under the circumstances. In our case, we have an example of what such reasonable conduct was, putting in a pass-through window, complying with the items set forth in the security report. It's not going to turn him into an insurer, a guarantor that there will never be any crime. And there could certainly be crime on the premises regardless of the best efforts. But that would not constitute necessarily negligence on the part of the landlord.
If there had been crime in the neighborhood, but not crime at his station, would you say that he still would have a duty to have a pass-through window?
I would say that he would under these circumstances.
So any service station in an area where there has been at least one robbery has a duty to its employees to establish pass-through windows?
Your Honor, without trying to argue with the court, I'm not trying to get from here to there. I think what you've described is probably true. But I cannot say that what you've described as being true in this case is going to be true for the U-Totem in Austin, because the situation is different. It's in a different location. The experience is different than with this Exxon station in Greenville.
Counsel, isn't this very breakdown of law and order to which Judge Cook referred, this change in societal conditions, one of the factors that the Court of Appeals looked to in saying how we should fashion the whole concept of duty that's at the core of this case?
The Court of Appeals in this case made direct reference to that in the initial part of its opinion, and that has been discussed by a number of commentators as well, ranging from an advocated position being that there should be, a landlord should be a guarantor, the reason being that it is more economically efficient for the system as a whole for this responsibility to fall on the landlord, who can build it into the cost of services instead of the individual. We're not advocating that, but that has certainly been a position that has been advocated. In this case, rather, we say simply, this is not a case that makes new law. The Court of Appeals opinion is based upon clear principles, Redinger, the clear issues of duty. There was control, there was negligence, and it approximately caused damages. And there is no reason to abandon the law or to change the law at this time. Thank you.
Any other questions?
May it please the Court, in a very brief response, I would like to play off of some of the Court's questions to see if we can advance the argument a bit. I want to talk about bay doors just a minute. Much is made of bay doors in the briefing, and you would think this whole case was about bay doors. I'm going to reiterate one more time. Bay doors was not pleaded as a ground of negligence, and it is not found as a basis for negligence in the Court's findings and conclusions. It is in this case only as evidence from plaintiff's perspective of an isolated incident of control. Whether or not you believe the so-called encouragement relative to bay doors is a type of control that was mandated by Exxon is immaterial, because under this Court's opinion in Love, a single sporadic incident of control is insufficient to establish liability.
I think I'm not sure that whether I understood Ms. Bolts correctly or not, but if I did, I don't think he hinged his argument on the fact that Exxon, as a matter of policy alone, required those bay doors to be kept open, or suggested very strongly with a hammer that they be kept open 24 hours a day to demonstrate to the public that this is an open and operating enterprise. If I understood him correctly, this was one element of this pervasive overall control, one which happened to relate very strongly to security under the circumstances of this case.
I'm glad you got that impression, because when I read the application, the response to the application for writ of error, I draw the exact opposite conclusion. But what I am saying is, I think that where you have put the matter is exactly where it belongs in this case, and it will not ultimately rise to the level, because it is not even an inherent part of the lease contract itself. It is only an isolated, if at best, suggestion separate and apart from the lease contract, bearing in mind the very onerous burden that has to be overcome under Love to make this contract a subterfuge.
If pervasive control is important, there is certainly more of that here than is necessary for an ordinary landlord-tenant relationship.
Depends on what you call an ordinary landlord-tenant relationship. If you put into the fray a specific use, I think that particularly under modern complex business relationships, and particularly because of the interplay of the Petroleum Fair Market Practices Act and the Lanham Act and other acts which overlay these particular kinds of leases, that's probably going to be true in almost every case. This lease, by the way, is in many respects a mirror image of the Petroleum Fair Marketing Practices Act, as well as almost verbatim quotations from this court's opinion as to what a landlord may do without making himself a master. So, yes, you're exactly correct.
Well, Mr. Hatchell, if this is not an ordinary landlord-tenant relationship, but one that's tailored to the nature of the industry involved, the nature of the enterprise involved, with those elements of control, for lack of a better term, that are essential to this function, to this enterprise, shouldn't the duty of the landlord in this case be adjusted accordingly? How can you argue for an ordinary standard of landlord-tenant duty when we have an extraordinary landlord-tenant relationship?
I'm not arguing that this gets out of the ordinary. It fits within the ordinary service station lease context. I mean, what is an ordinary landlord-tenant relationship, particularly in a commercial lease context, when you have conveyed away particularly the entire premises, but you have an ongoing business relationship which more or less drives that? What I think your concern is, you may really believe that landlords need to be guarantors and insurers, because that seems to be where the problem comes in. And that may well be a philosophical choice that this court makes, but you punish Exxon in that process for doing precisely what this court said it could do and not become a master and not become liable.
So the law, you would have us define is the converse, that no matter how much violent crime occurs at any Exxon service station, if it maintains the kind of lease it has now, it will have no responsibility for it.
Precisely, Your Honor, and that is a core philosophical question that this court faces, seems to me, because the question then becomes who is in the best position to exercise security measures to prevent crime. This particular lease, in response to Mr. Justice Heck's question, does put the duty of security in paragraph 6D on the tenant. But the best example I can give, Justice Doggett, to answer your question is precisely the way this accident occurred. Terry Tidwell was shot as he came off of the apron into the premises to write up a sale, which he had made in response to a full service type service station arrangement. He was not and could not be behind steel plate and bulletproof glass because Mr. Morgan, his employer, had a full service station and he was outside tending a customer seconds before he was shot. Now, how in the world can Exxon provide security measures when it has no control over the manner in which Mr. Morgan does his business? So it seems to me that the philosophical point at which you decide this case is to say Morgan is in the best position of anyone to implement security measures. Exxon made a number of avenues available to him. And the position I think that you would take, if it were implemented to make the landlord an insurer, would, as Mr. Justice Cornyn suggests, simply say, well, all right, then why should we even try? And I think that that is a very, very dangerous course for this court to pursue. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? Thank you. That concludes the arguments. And the first call, the court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.